People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. We're in the midst of a psychedelic renaissance, according to numerous headlines, stretching back close to 10 years. After decades in the underground, psychedelics are making their way closer and closer to the mainstream. Substances like psilocybin, ketamine, and MDMA are being touted for their therapeutic potential. Clinical trials are progressing, and some jurisdictions like Colorado and Australia have changed laws to pave the way for sanctioned medical use of psychedelics. But amidst the buzz, some have expressed concerns that psychedelics risk falling victim to corporate capture. There are fears that profit and the medical system could co-opt psychedelics and use them to reinforce institutional power structures. Jamie Brownlee and Kevin Walby explore these ideas in their new book, Psychedelic Capitalism. Brownlee teaches at Carleton University in Ottawa. Walby is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Winnipeg. Today on the program, the two of them will share insights and concerns about the present and future of psychedelics.
Kevin Walby, University of Winnipeg. I'm in a department called criminal justice.
And I'm Jamie Brownlee. I'm an instructor at Carleton University in a number of different departments, including sociology, law and legal studies, and geography and environmental studies. So I teach about a number of different things.
And you're both the authors of a new book, Psychedelic Capitalism. I'm hoping to talk to you today about a number of the issues you identified in that book. Maybe the place to start, could you just give folks an idea of where psychedelics are at in Canada in 2025 and sort of how did we get here?
It's a good question. For folks who aren't aware, we're currently in what some people are calling a psychedelic renaissance. And that refers to the resurgence of interest in psychedelics, a resurgence of scientific and research-based interests in psychedelics. But in the book, what we point out is that there's a lot of other folks who are interested in psychedelics too, like corporations, pharmaceutical companies, some people on the far right of the political spectrum. There's a lot of people interested in psychedelics who maybe one wouldn't assume might be if they associate psychedelics with 1960s counterculture or with sacred indigenous traditions. So in the book, what we really want to do is flesh out who is involved in this so-called psychedelic renaissance and what are the implications for thinking about access, thinking about health, and thinking about the future of this domain, whether it will be subjected to corporate capture, corporate control in the way that some other areas of life and society have been.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, we look at Canada and the United States quite extensively in the book. We're really focused on North America. It's really where most of the action is. And Kevin talked about a psychedelic renaissance. I mean, you could also see it as a process of psychedelic mainstreaming. And, you know, like a lot of other people who have been watching this area, keeping a close eye on it and seeing the progress that's been going on the last decade or so, you know, we began this work, I would say, with, you know, a sense of naive optimism, even enthusiasm that, you know, this psychedelic renaissance, this process of mainstreaming, you know, could represent in many ways, you know, a positive development, you know, for a society and a culture that seems increasingly bent on self-destruction more every day, it seems. But, you know, as we dug a little deeper into this process of you know, so-called mainstreaming, our enthusiasm was dampened, right? We got quite concerned that the psychedelic renaissance may not be a positive force for change, but could actually entrench systems of social and economic inequality, and actually cause significant social harm along the way. And that's part of what motivated us to write the book. You know, we saw very little critical commentary out there about the impacts of capitalism, you know, of corporate power, of corporate capture, of the medicalization process. And so that's really one of the things that, you know, motivated us to get involved in this area. We, you know, we don't want the process of mainstreaming to end in those things. We would very much like this to be a positive development in many different ways, but right now we're quite skeptical that that will be the case.
Throughout today's show, we'll also hear from Shannon Dames. Dames is chair for psychedelic programming at Vancouver Island University in Nanaimo. The school offers a graduate certificate in psychedelic-assisted therapy. It was the first accredited Canadian university to offer a credential in the field. I asked her for some context about psychedelics.
So it's an emerging field, and it's really, to be more specific, it's a re-emerging field because psychoactive medicines have been in the research world, in the medical world, and really traditionally in our kind of cultural world going back a couple thousand years now. And it is in the last 10 years, especially, I would say, we're trying to understand how the field fits in the current colonial structures. And it's complicated because they're not entirely clinical. They're not entirely spiritual. They're really a blend of both.
I asked Dames, what are the pathways people can take to access psychedelics in Canada at the moment?
I'd break it into like three different categories. One category is they can be prescribed just like any other medication by a prescriber, a nurse practitioner, or a physician. And that would pertain to like ketamine-assisted therapy. Given when ketamine is given in certain dose ranges, it has psychedelic effects. So you can have psychedelic-assisted therapy by getting a prescription for ketamine at those doses in, of course, like a regulated setting. That's one bucket. You don't need special approval. There are, when it is going through the kind of Western clinical paradigm, in order for prescribers to prescribe it, there needs to be an indication or a diagnosis that matches why that's being prescribed. So that can be a barrier for folks if they don't have an official diagnosis and they're wanting to access ketamine-assisted therapy. The other bucket is for medications like psilocybin, also known as magic mushrooms when kind of growing in the wild, and MDMA, which is kind of associated with treatment for PTSD. So those two medications are in kind of late research phases or advanced clinical trial phases, and they are available for public use through a special access program. So that would mean that a prescriber needs to get permission from Health Canada to access it. And once they are approved, then that medication is released for the use of psychedelic-assisted therapy. So there's three right now that you can legally access through the regulated healthcare system, and that's ketamine, psilocybin, and MDMA. And all of them have kind of their own standards and specific uses attached to them. And actually, sorry, the third bucket is, which is becoming a growing practice, is people are just going around all the red tape and the challenges getting through the system to get permissions, and they are finding psychedelic-assisted therapy in the unregulated underground, and that is considered illegal. And I'm also situating myself here on Vancouver Island in BC, Western Canada, and that underground market is bulging here. So it's a bit like a two-tiered mental health system in some ways, with the way kind of regulations have become quite rigid, and people, including regulated practitioners, are deciding to go around it because they have moral distress or an ethical imperative to treat people that the system, the publicly offered treatments in the system, are no longer helping.
Dames says we shouldn't think of psychedelics as some kind of magic pill.
At this place that where I'm kind of sitting with research, education, and service delivery, the challenge with it going solely through a medical system that is pretty research centered, I'm being choosy with my words here because I'm likely going to offend somebody by saying this, but psychedelics were never meant to be offered as a band-aid approach, kind of like going to a pharmacy and getting an antibiotic and taking it like it's going to fix you, like some kind of magic pill. They are an amplifier to a larger therapeutic process. So meaning you would go through a therapy process and you would receive a psychoactive medicine to help you like soften a rigid ego system, to help you get through rigid patterns, but it is supported by a wider therapy process. We don't have that kind of template in our current clinical system. So our current clinical system prescribes medications. You go pick it up. There's generally, you aren't supervised while you take it. You're not in a relational therapeutic alliance that is supporting you in your like longer term healing journey. And so the risk is that we, you know, like we have done in many colonial systems, is that we objectify these medicines. We don't understand their larger spiritual implications. Because we don't understand those implications, we actually aren't competent to support them. And we see people as just biological beings that don't have those other holistic components. And we don't address those components, which means we're going to have less effective therapy. And it can even lead to harm.
You're listening to People First Radio. We're exploring psychedelic-assisted therapy on today's program. You were just hearing from Shannon Dames from Vancouver Island University. She's chair of the school's psychedelic programming. We'll hear more from her throughout the program. In their new book, Psychedelic Capitalism, university professors Jamie Brownlee and Kevin Walby argue that psychedelics are too important to be appropriated and commodified by institutional power structures. Throughout the book, they talk about the concept of set and setting, which they call one of the most important features of the psychedelic experience. Here's Brownlee explaining what those terms, set and setting, mean.
Psychedelics are highly context dependent, right? They've been famously described as non-specific amplifiers of the non-specific amplifiers that mirror or magnify particular states of mind. As you said, they're very heavily dependent upon set and setting. Set being the personality, intentions, expectations of the user, as well as, and setting being, you know, the political, economic, and cultural environments within which these experiences take place. So in other words, you know, psychedelics don't have, a lot of people think they do, but they don't have essentialized outcomes. You know, a lot of people today say that psychedelics have essentialized political outcomes. They turn people into kindler, gentler people, and they almost automatically lead to a more just and progressive society. If you know, put these substances in the mainstream, that's what's going to happen. But they don't, you know. Psychedelics can do, the research literature suggests psychedelics can do a number of very positive things for individuals and even potentially for society, but that's not guaranteed. And, you know, in today's political landscape, what psychedelics will do if they sort of, you know, enter the mainstream is it's very uncertain. It is highly dependent on set and setting. And so that should be recognized right off the bat.
And we argue that the mainstreaming of psychedelics has major implications for what's possible. And it's kind of already leading to a narrowing of the discourse around psychedelics, a narrowing of the setting, if you like. So in traditional indigenous uses of plant medicines, there's a lot of different perspectives within that, but it's almost like a relationship with a plant teacher. And it's about this kind of symbiotic relationship with the plant teacher or the sacred medicine. In the 1960s, there was a setting focused on changing society and changing one's self, exploration, and justice. Today, in the medical model, all of that is kind of pushed to the side. And that's another big thing that's at stake here, is that any other kind of set and setting outside of the medical framing of individualized health optimization, yeah, or in the case of use of microdosing in Silicon Valley, for example, optimization of labor performance. All other considerations are kind of off the table with this corporatized, medicalized approach to psychedelics. So part of what we're doing in the book is saying, hang on here a minute. Like, there are so many other pasts and futures of psychedelics that we need to keep in mind here and keep alive, and that any kind of legal reform should also be cognitive of and, in a sense, trying to protect.
And there's a lot of promise there, but at the same time, the hype remains well ahead of the science. If you just quick glance, media articles over the last few years are touting psychedelics as, wonder therapies, miracle drugs, that's going to revolutionize the mental health system. We don't know that yet, right? We go through a lot of the problems with that line of thinking, the medical model more generally. When people believe, and I think millions of people do believe, that these are now miracle drugs, and they have great expectations about, if they have their own problems, mental health issues, and so on, that this is what's going to fix them, right? This is what's going to ultimately help them. Well, maybe, but it could also lead to something, worse. And unrestrained hype can be quite dangerous for potential patients when that hype isn't realized. It can make their symptoms worse. It can make their conditions worse, and so on. And it can also lead to a situation where instances of harm, abuse, adverse events, all things that are happening within the broader landscape. I mean, those are kind of minimized and pushed under the rug. There are interests that have a great financial stake in medicalization. And so if anything untoward arises, they're usually met with silence or dismissal. So there's kind of those twin things happening at the same time. We don't dismiss medicalization. The literature shows a lot of promise. At the same time, we do caution quite strongly against unrestrained hype, because it can actually be quite damaging.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of shadowy parts to medicalization of psychedelics that we argue people aren't really tuned into quite yet. So another one is that there are these companies with pharmaceutical interests that are creating what are called new generation or next generation psychedelics. And what they're trying to do is get rid of the high, but just have whatever the purported benefit of psychedelics are for the patient. And they're trying to push psychedelics into this kind of like pharmaceutical model, in a sense, and push it away from the other things that psychedelics have been associated with, like mystical experience, with opening one's mind and heart. So this is a major tendency towards the kind of next generation psychedelics.
And just to build on that, Kevin, do you mind if I interrupt?
Go ahead.
Alongside what Kevin said, I mean, you see this big push to turn psychedelics, including through the development of next generation psychedelics, like Kevin said, into a pill mill model, the kind of model favored by big pharma. So companies like Mind Medicine, Compass Pathways, Tire Life Sciences, others, Kevin's right. Not only in some cases are they trying to get rid of the psychedelic experience altogether, make it so, it's just a kind of a biological model of treatment, but they're reducing and in some cases eliminating the psychotherapeutic component of psychedelic assisted therapy, because that's more costly and time consuming and resource intensive. So in order to make themselves more attractive to investors, and even the FDA, regulatory bodies, they are reducing or eliminating, the psychotherapeutic components of psychedelic therapy, even though the literature strongly suggests that psychotherapy in combination with drug administration leads to much better results for patients. So that's one trend that has been very alarming. And It's also one, it's the model that's favored by big pharma. You know, if psychedelics ever want to be incorporated, and a lot of their executives do, into sort of the big pharma model, there's going to be pressure in exactly those directions, right? To make it so psychedelics are basically, you know, a pill, ideally a pill you take every day and for the rest of your lives. I mean, that's the big pharma model. It's so lucrative. They're not interested in therapies that may get a deeper structure, deeper root, the deeper causes of mental illness. They want to keep people sick, essentially. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that. So, you know, as psychedelics are thrust into the world of psychedelic capitalism, these developments are very concerning to us.
We've also seen the emergence or the implementation of a medical model in a few places where psychedelics have been legalized. So if you think of the example of Australia, in Australia currently, one can access MDMA, and one can access psilocybin, but only based on a prescription through one's doctor, and it can only be used in this very clinical setting. Now, I don't know about you or anybody else listening, but the last place that I personally would want to do psychedelics is in this clinical, clerical space with the strange doctor. You know, I would like to have other options for use, but that's where the medicalized model is heading. Not to mention that in Australia, the cost per use, or for cost per treatment, if you like, and I'd put treatment in scare quote or parenthetical kind of marks there, is really expensive. Like, no one who is working class could probably afford it.
It's tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah.
So it's not a model that is sustainable or beneficial in the ways that I think other models could be. And it's really geared towards control of knowledge around the body and the mind by psychiatrists, by doctors. It's really geared towards financial benefit. These are some of the concerns that we have about the direction the medicalization of psychedelics is headed.
Back at VIU, psychedelics chair Shannon Dames says there's a risk that we think we can just overlay psychedelic drugs on our traditional medical model.
We as a society we're not well, right? Like we as a society are really not well. If you look at our mental health across the spectrum, mental health providers, those of us that are trying to serve those with mental health conditions, actually are less well than the people that we are trying to help. Our mental health statistics are even worse than the general public. So just laying a bit of that context, that yes, there is a lot of potential with these medicines. We have been practicing in what I'll call the ordinary treatment world, giving medications, lots of talk therapy, all sorts of models on how you can vary those medications and that talk therapy. And for a lot of people, that's not working. So the other option is to work in non-ordinary healing spaces. So that's like the second bucket, and that's with psychoactive medicines. The risk is that we think that those psychoactive medicines can just be kind of like immersed into our ordinary treatment world, when actually the mechanism of treatment is entirely different. So this renaissance of like, yes, they are coming back, and because there was a long phase of prohibition, and they've never really left, quite honestly. Those, when I talked about the underground earlier, there have been people practicing in the underground that have carried psychedelic therapy all through the prohibition. There's been cultures that have been working with psychedelics since time immemorial and have continued through colonization. And the opportunity here with this reemergence is really for us to lean in with a lot of curiosity, a lot of humility, and a lot of respect for what it would mean to carry carry these medicines, which are not just biological. They, many would argue, are more spiritual than they are biological. And are we, as a culture, as a people, as a society, as trained, regulated professions, are we capable and competent of carrying spiritual medicines when we often are, our spiritual bucket is often pretty dry, and a lot of us are pretty darn neurotic with lots of letters after our name, which isn't always the best profile to be supporting people in spiritual processes. So that's my long way of saying, yes, we are in a psychedelic renaissance. We have access to promising medications. We've not seen this kind of promising solutions for decades. And we are also at real risk of repeating past mistakes and moving forward in ways that are either too rigid or too loose and causing harm in the process.
This is People First Radio. We're focusing on psychedelics on today's program. Vancouver Island University Psychedelics Chair Shannon Dames spoke to me about some of the issues that can come with research into psychedelic therapy.
There, I said there was three buckets earlier, and the fourth bucket is research, and that people can access these through research, not just the ones I mentioned, but other ones as well. Some of the challenge, I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but research studies are research-centered. They're not patient-centered, right? So, and what I mean by that is if you get really patient-centered and you allow more flexible dosing ranges based on the biology of the person and their experience, and you allow comorbidities, meaning they can come into the study with more than one diagnosis. You allow variations in their treatment based on their unique cultural and life experience needs. That becomes a patient-centered treatment. Unfortunately, that also means that you have introduced all sorts of confounding factors to a research study. So there's this kind of like, I think, a real threat in pushing all these psychedelics through clinical trials and thinking we're going to get there when what it's meaning is really sterilized set and settings. We're not varying things based on patient needs nearly enough. Of course, there's some of that. And really looking at, like, how do we do this in a patient-centered way? And how do we study more real-world research with real people that have confounding factors and recognize, yes, the data is going to be a bit messier. And we're going to be treating people according to their needs, not according to the data that we get at the end of it.
Who is driving the bus when it comes to advancements on psychedelic, I'll say, research or like availability?
Health Canada. Yeah, it is our government. And so there's two buckets that, and, you know, it often comes to funding. So there's the kind of corporate pharmaceutical world that often spend millions of dollars running trials because it takes more than one. It's usually at least three. They're very expensive, like multi-million. And they're investing knowing that on the back end, they're going to patent a drug that they are going to sell for a large amount of money to hopefully recoup all the money they spent on the trials. So it's the access issues become quite great, actually, if we push them all through clinical trials like this, because we're going to have drug companies with patents that then have very expensive medications so that they can make their money back on the back end. And that, again, it's not about the patient. We're in a business model now that is all about bottom line and making sure these companies don't go bankrupt. So the other pathway for clinical trials is through university-led or investigator-led studies. And they are funded through Health Canada, and they're incredibly competitive, also very research-based, often quite sterile, so that they get significant outcomes, not a bunch of noisy data, because they've customized their treatment. And it's challenging as well. You have researchers that spend enormous amounts of time writing grants that are a little bit like winning the lottery if you happen to win one. I am a researcher myself, and I know that the more letters and research I get into, the more neurotic I become. And I'm not sure that research is the area that can really honor the kind of spiritual needs that these medicines are calling for, because we don't know how to research the spiritual sides of this. It's actually easier for us to cut it out.
In their book, Psychedelic Capitalism, Jamie Brownlee and Kevin Walby address some of the methodological challenges with psychedelic research. I asked Brownlee about some of those challenges.
And you also outline how just some systemic factors with how clinical trials are conducted might be shaping the way this plays out in negative ways. Things like exclusion criteria for who is allowed to be part of the clinical trials that are informing the research on this. Things like the fact that it's hard to do a double-blind trial with a placebo when it's pretty easy to tell who's on a psychedelic and who is not. Things like the fact that set and setting, the context of where you are doing psychedelics are so important in what the effects will be, but the very nature of a clinical trial is intended to kind of make it replicable anywhere in any context. I'm wondering if you could speak to some of those factors.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a... If I remember right, a whole section devoted to, you know, methodological challenges. And psychedelic medicine, I mean, all of this kind of research has methodological challenges, but I think we think that psychedelic research, they're quite acute. You mentioned some of them. Blinding, you know, blinding is a huge issue. Now, it's an issue across the mental health field in this kind of research, but it's particularly acute with psychedelics because they have, you know, very noticeable behavioral and subjective effects. Some researchers have tried to get around this issue by using what are called active placebos, which also have, you know, certain mental effects, behavioral effects, but it's very tricky. I mean, some of them act as kind of stimulants, which can bias results. You know, others just don't work at all. So, and you look at the literature on blinding, I mean, it's almost... it almost doesn't work at all in psychedelic medicine, which is a huge, huge roadblock. There's other issues too. Something like, you know, the lack of diverse cultural, you know, ethnic representation in psychedelic research. This is almost all, you know, white people in rich areas of the world that are undergoing this. That hampers the generalizability of research findings. It also hampers the development of culturally specific treatments. And as something I mentioned before, expectations. You know, the expectations of patients in these trials are so high that many have surmised, and I think they're right, that this is biasing the outcomes. In fact, some patients believe, and we know this from what they say, that if they don't report positive results, they are jeopardizing the entire movement. And sometimes they're actually told that by psychedelic researchers. You know, you're going to make history here, so, you know, careful what you say. You know, that's on the record in several clinical trials. So that's another source of research bias. So there are all kinds of things that I just mentioned, but also didn't talk about. You can, you know, go to the section in the book where we talk about it that really cast further doubt, or at least warrant, you know, more attention in terms of, you know, legitimacy of this research. I mean, some have described psychedelics as placebos on rocket boosters. You know, the placebo effect may be so important here that, you know, it's having an enormous effect on research outcomes. You talked about set and setting. Well, that's another area where the medical model is really conflicting. Yes, psychedelics, the importance of set and setting is huge, but basically companies running clinical trials want to get rid of set and setting. They want to get rid of the impacts of set and setting. They want to focus on the actions of the drug, and that's consistent with a big pharma model. So all sorts of methodological challenges that researchers are going to have to come to better grips with.
Brownlee says many of the people at the forefront of the psychedelic movement had transformative experiences with psychedelics outside of clinical settings.
Psychedelic capitalists, the people who are at the forefront of this industry, CEOs of psychedelic companies, you know, high-level executives, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, so many of them say that they entered this field because of the personally transformative experiences that they had with these substances, or that people close to them have had with these substances. You know, some psychedelic capitalists even say that psychedelics saved their lives by allowing them to overcome addiction, intractable depression, anxiety, you know, so on and so forth. But what's quite interesting is that, you know, you would presume, I think, that, and all of those, I should say, occurred outside of a clinical setting, right? This was not through the medical model, right? This was in recreational venues or venues where psychedelics were legal. And you would expect, I think, maybe it was naive, but you would expect that those personally meaningful and transformative experiences that they experienced or their family members did would lead them to champion broad, equitable access, would lead them to be critical of the broader drug war, which it may even lead them to support things like decriminalization or legalization outside of a strict medical framework. What we discovered, though, was that was not the case at all. You know, almost to a person, all of these people who had these experiences remain, you know, adamant that these substances should not be available to people outside of the medical model. You know, so we asked the question, what's going on here? There seems to be some incongruity here, but it actually does make a lot of sense. I mean, those at the top of this industry want to limit people's access to psychedelics to anything really outside of a medical pharma frame. Why is that? Well, because that's the model that they are going to profit from, through exclusivity, through intellectual property, through confining access to the medical route. And so, you know, we thought that was quite revealing. You could say that humane and rational drug policy is bad for business. You know, their success almost depends upon continuing to prosecute, put people in jail for using drugs outside of a medical model. And that's not something that, you know, we don't think that's the best avenue of access. We think it's actually going to contribute to existing health inequalities, economic inequalities. So you're right, there's all kinds of wealthy, influential people singing the praises of psychedelics, but within the industry, at least when it comes down to it, you see a very different stance in terms of what they actually want to see happen with psychedelics in the mainstream.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Throughout the program, we've been hearing two conversations. One I had with Jamie Brownlee and Kevin Walby. They're the authors of a book called Psychedelic Capitalism, which explores a number of issues in the emerging field of psychedelic-assisted therapy. You've also been hearing excerpts from a conversation I had with Shannon Dames. She's chair of psychedelic programming at Vancouver Island University in Nanaimo. The school offers a graduate certificate in psychedelic-assisted therapy.
When we put profit in the middle of healthcare, it causes a distortion that is very hard to work around. And if the systems cannot offer these in the public system, and I don't have great faith that they will anytime soon, really just due to lack of awareness and fear, private organizations need to start up to like take this work until the systems can get there. The for-profit models, I find, I think it's challenging, A, because we're in Canada and this is, healthcare is kind of seen as a basic right. It creates additional accessibility issues and it creates this temptation in, you know, even if it doesn't drive us 90% of the time in our 10% sleepier moments when finances become the center, we also lose that patient-centered focus, much like I was talking about research studies that might get prioritize research-centered. So just doing what we can. If we need to create a nonprofit system outside of our public system, then let's do it and not put profits in the middle of it.
What are some of the ways that profit is negatively influencing the development of psychedelic therapy?
The clearest example of that would be is if you've got a group of investors that enable a corporation to start up that are expecting dividends or expecting profit coming from treatment, and you have those that are running the organization are answering to that board, and those investors and their voice is like very powerful because they essentially are the make or break of whether it keeps going. Then you then have operational people that are having to satisfy the financial, the financial wants of overseers. Versus another situation where you might have a nonprofit board where the finances are, you know, anything that's profit goes towards scholarships and people that can't afford it. And that piece about skimping and making things as efficient as possible and removing the relational aspects so things can be quicker and there's more of a revolving door, or even, you know, stickiness where you want people to keep coming back. So it's like incentivizing sickness. All of that is problematic. So we need to find ways to keep the profits out of the priority pool. It's you know, if we can find ways that they are just a side note, but not impacting the decisions we're making in treatment, then great. But as long as it's informing how we treat people, they really don't belong there.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
So when you have something like a corporatized ketamine clinic or a corporatized psychedelic clinic, the incentive for the clinic is to get people in and out as quick as possible, because then your overhead is lower, the amount of money you're spending on a guide or therapist is lower. And so you don't have someone sitting with someone for hours and hours after, you know, talking through what happened, working on integration, having follow-up meetings. And something could go really wrong there. You know, someone could have anxiety that they can't necessarily work through if they're just pushed out the door so that the next person can come in and, you know, have some ketamine or whatever. And this is where Jamie's right. There's a kind of balancing act in underground therapeutic settings and in traditional indigenous uses, right? There are guides who will sit with you for days and days to help you work through what's happening. So there's an assumption with the medicalization of psychedelics that, you know, these professionals, these people with all the letters behind their names, they're the ones who can make things safer. But I don't think that that's true. I think there's a lot of people in the underground of psychedelics who know how to do psychedelic harm reduction much better. And at the same time, there is a potential for therapist abuse. So maybe there's a need for some kind of regulations to make sure, you know, if there is an abuser who is a therapist out there, that they aren't, you know, able to work in this field. Same as with any therapist or psychiatrist, right? Like anyone, as we know, in the medical field could also engage in this kind of abuse. There's a lot of power over there. So there is a need for some kind of regulation, but I would not simply jump to the conclusion, like a lot of people behind the hype are, that psychiatrists and clinicians are the best people to engage in harm reduction to mitigate the risks that are out there.
And I'd just like to quickly follow up on something Kevin said when he mentioned ketamine. You know, one of the things I didn't mention, there are important differences between psychedelics themselves in terms of their risk profiles, certainly. I think, you know, ibogaine, for example, which can cause serious heart issues, is one, and ketamine's another. You know, ketamine is not the same thing as, you know, psilocybin, LSD, and so on. Ketamine can have serious health impacts, physiological impacts, certainly. It's also very, it's addictive. And ketamine causes dependence, unlike some other psychedelics that do not lead to physical dependence. And when Kevin mentioned ketamine clinics, ketamine is the one psychedelic that's kind of out there, right? It's an FDA-approved anesthetic. It's now being used off-label for other conditions. And if you look at the for-profit ketamine industry, it's a nightmare. I think it looks horrifying. Package deals, incentivized deals to get people to use more ketamine in this for-profit structure. A very little emphasis, as Kevin said, on psychotherapy of any kind, integration, support. It really is a pill mill model. Ideally, they just want to shove ketamine into people's hands and get them to use more of it. It kind of offers a terrifying glimpse into the future of corporatized psychedelic medicine. I mean, if that's the model, we got a lot of trouble on our hands.
What do you think the specific case of ketamine being the thing that people can most easily access, if it's fair to say that right now in North America, what do you think that whole affair says about just the way this psychedelic movement is unfolding within the medical system?
To me, one thing it points to is that the corporatized, medicalized model, it's about speed, right? They want people in and out quick. And ketamine is something that you can do that with, because it's not an 8-hour trip, it's not a 10-hour trip. And from what I understand, you do need to have repeat sessions. It has to keep going. So in that way, it's really amenable to the medicalized model. And the quicker a trip, the more people you can have in a clinic every day. And that makes money for the clinic. It makes money for the companies. Whereas with psilocybin, how many people could you have in a therapy center in a day? Maybe a handful of people, right? Because it's a longer duration. So speed is one big thing, I think, that ketamine points to.
Or, look at the advertising for these clinics. It's crazy. The only condition for which there is some evidence of the effectiveness of ketamine is treatment-resistant depression. There's some evidence that can be effective in treating this, maybe. But it's being advertised for every possible condition you can think of. I almost mean that quite literally. Depression, anxiety, PTSD, go through the list. I mean, it's being advertised as a cure-all for the struggles of modern existence. And you can see it in their advertising. These clinics are promising cures, extremely shady. And this is kind of outside some of the regulation that exists for making false claims about or highly misleading hyped claims about these medicines. So, that's just another thing. And if psilocybin, LSD, and so on are eventually approved as medicines in some fashion, you can expect the same thing probably in private clinics. Psilocybin will cure everything that ails you, right? That's very dangerous. And Kevin mentioned ketamine short acting effects. It's true. The effects wear off actually quite quickly. They tend to. So you need this maintenance dosing, right? Which means the clinics can sell more and more ketamine. The ketamine model, highly problematic would be a significant understatement.
Maybe just as a note to leave it on, where do you think this is going? Or maybe what do you think someone who is interested in where this is going, what do you think they can do about it? Or what do you think it's important for them to pay attention to as maybe the psychedelic renaissance continues or evolves?
Well, what comes to my mind, and I'll turn it over to Kevin, is, where do we go from here? What are the biggest threats to a just psychedelic future? We disagree with a lot of advocates, in this area, especially those who believe that we need to work through, send these substances through existing institutions and not to threaten them, right? Not to threaten existing institutions. People like Michael Pollan, for example, who obviously wrote a very important book on psychedelics. He thinks that the biggest danger to all this not working out is carelessness, right? Lacking a proper cultural container that doesn't threaten governments, doesn't threaten capitalism as a whole, right? We really need to support work psychedelics into the dominant institutions in a way that doesn't threaten them. We don't believe that. You know, we argue that these institutions themselves represent the biggest threat, you know, to a just and equitable psychedelic future. You know, the powerful combination of venture capitalists, you know, billionaire investors, pharmaceutical firms, you know, medical gatekeepers, and so on. You know, we don't think the overriding goal of the so-called psychedelic renaissance should be to restore the legitimacy of these substances in ways that these actors can accept. You know, instead, we think we need to not only challenge these power structures for all kinds of reasons, but also the role that psychedelics might play in supporting them. I mean, that's really the biggest fear, is that psychedelics are going to enter the mainstream and end up, you know, supporting or, you know, reinforcing the ills of our culture. And they can do that in various ways. I mean, these substances are entering an institutional context that's extremely unjust. And so, you know, are they just going to make everything worse? You know, it's certainly a possibility. Sure hope not. We don't want them to merely reproduce and entrench the ills of our culture. So we disagree with a lot of advocates on that question. And I guess we'll see how things play out, but pretty firm in that belief.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. Today on the program, we're talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy. You're hearing sections of two conversations I had. The first was with Jamie Brownlee and Kevin Walby. Brownlee teaches at Carleton University in Ottawa. Walby teaches at the University of Winnipeg. The pair are authors of a new book, Psychedelic Capitalism, which explores a number of issues in the field of psychedelic therapy. You're also hearing sections of a conversation I had with Shannon Dames. She's chair of psychedelic programming at Vancouver Island University in Nanaimo.
Yeah, well, it's, if you look at some of the psychedelics, and I'll just speak to psilocybin. Psilocybin is not addictive. It's not biologically addictive. In fact, if you keep taking it, it will have less of an effect, right? You need to actually have long spaces between you when you take it for it to be really effective. I think, based on my understanding of the history, is a lot of how some of these medications got put into these controlled labels is around threat to society. And back when that was done, and they were a threat to society, right? They were causing people to really question the systems around them. And that is likely a thread of why that all happened in the first place. In reality, like, I don't believe, I'm not an extremist by any means, I think I'm trying to find a middle way here. I don't really believe that humans in the state that we are at right now, particularly in these developed countries that have enormously high mental health rates, and really don't live our life out of much choice at all. We live our life more out of reaction states and survivalism for a lot of the population, not all of the population. So I'm not sure we're actually a responsible people to be in good relationship with medicines. We're not even in good relationship with ourselves and each other. So I don't know if we know how to not objectify and use these substances in a way that leads to harm. And so we create external policing mechanisms because we aren't actually responsible to make these decisions ourselves. So we need structures outside of us to tell us what to do and to kind of keep high potential substances away so that we don't, you know, impulsively use them and cause harm. I don't think one extreme or the other is the answer here. I really think there's like a middle way of us trying to find a way to regulate these that makes them accessible to all people, not just those that have a lot of money that can afford private treatment or have enough connections to be able to get a physician to advocate for them to access it. Like, my big issue is access. And the more regulated we become, the less accessible they become, the more loose we become, the more we see a lot of irresponsible kind of medicine carriers and deliverers and dealers. So as we get better, until we get better as a society and are able to live with kind of more authenticity, alignment, integrity, ultimately, we need those external regulatory structures. Do we need to tighten them up as much as they are now so that we have people working around them and creating an entire different tier of mental health care? Nope, that would be a sign that maybe we're not hitting the mark. It is not working. So like, how do we find a middle ground where we can have a bit of both without either extreme happening on both ends?
Do you have any answers to that question?
I keep going back to this, how we train in at the university and how we really work through the nonprofit Roots to Thrive locally is we for us, it's about staying in relationship, like really doing our work, not becoming divisive or saying this is right and this is wrong, and like leaning in out of curiosity and finding a middle place. So all that to say, like, it's I don't think regulators are bad. I don't think policymakers are bad. I don't think the people making the laws and upholding them and creating access issues are bad. They're all responding appropriately to a society that's really quite chaotic right now. And at the same token, there's a good reason why there's an underground. And there's a lot of really good work happening down there. A lot of people are getting better in the unregulated underground. And there's real risks down there. There's people that are practicing in isolation that are really not in a good state, and there is nobody overseeing what they're doing. That is not safe. So it's, I think the path here is that we should be talking about this and not drawing these like hard lines on both sides, but regulators, educators, healthcare providers, we're working together, and finding a bit of a negotiable middle ground where, it's kind of like a bad divorce or something, like everyone can live with how we go forward. And it may not be exactly what the regulators want. It may not be exactly what people that are, decrim, no regulation want, but we find a place in the middle where everybody can tolerate it.
Shannon Dames is chair of psychedelic programming at Vancouver Island University in Nanaimo. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.